All right, here we are again. We're going to talk about the 12 concepts for world service. And just by way of maybe a little brief introduction to this phase of it, I didn't even know there was such a thing for a long time. And I imagine there's some in the group here that today that this might be their first go at it. So my sponsor in Wyoming was a past alternate delegate from Nebraska about panel 22. And he took me out to a fishing bank one day and introduced these things from road. So, and I had no idea. In those days, you could get the 12 concepts separate from the AA service manual. I guess you still can, but it was a little blue book. And I got a hold of one of those things, and I began to explore this business of the 12 concepts of world service, and or for world service. And I was always really intrigued by what I saw in there in the way of the principles that underlie them, that lie under them. And the need to reconcile maybe some of the problems that arose out of the second tradition as well as the ninth tradition with respect to these service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. And Bill and recognized in the late 40s after Dr. Bob got sick that life is a terminal experience. Mm-hmm. And so he knew that one day was going to come, he was going to have to go on to the big meeting. But Bill loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think a lot of people will tell you that Bill Wilson was not a very humble man. But I will say to you that one of the greatest acts of humility ever performed by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous was the fact that Bill was willing, maybe not always completely, totally, but he was willing to let this fellowship have itself and to be accountable for itself and to take care of its own affairs. He made an optimistic statement in 1955 in St. Louis that we had come of age, and I think it was an optimistic statement. I see a lot of evidence that we haven't come of age. But by the same token, he believed that it was probably time for a change of guard. The fellowship's collective conscience had resided for years in Bill and Bob's head. Anytime there was problems, just call Bill. And, of course, Bill, you know, might have been having a bad day. You know, and he'd say, the hell with him, you know, or whatever. And the group would go right back and say, that's what Bill says, he's the man. And so, you know, but that was not a very effective way of trying to let this fellowship kind of steer itself. So Bernard Smith was a Class A trustee. And he was an international lawyer, and he was pretty hepped up on words, and he had a good feel, I think, for how we do things in Alcoholics Anonymous. So he and Bill sat down and started to try to pin these principles out, and I think finally they culminated with the essays, as we see them now, pretty much, in the 60s. So the 12 concepts are basically the principles by which the General Service Conference operates. However, others have gone along and seen that these principles have application, and so a lot of area committees, area assemblies, district committees, and even groups have adopted these principles as a manner of operating their affairs, as it were. And I think one of the interesting things is that over the last few years, and I can't even tell you how many, some people have begun to discover that these have a personal application as well. So I didn't want to steal any of Don's thunder, but I kind of feel like it's important. Most of us in this room probably will not ever have the opportunity to experience Alcoholics Anonymous at the level much above an area or below. And some of us are unfortunately or fortunately, as the case may be, going to be put in the barrel and be asked to be a delegate and perhaps a trustee. And you know, there's some question, I suppose, about whether or not these have any application if we, in fact, are not going to serve at any level below the area. And again, I want to reiterate that a lot of area assemblies have adopted these principles to operate by. So
John, you want to? Do you do fine?
No. Should we kind of glance at the first concept, maybe?
Well, let me first give a little short overview. Again, I need to have visuals so that I can grasp things. Again, the first concept states it's a statement of principle and of what the problem is going to be, and the rest of them tell me how to do that. The tradition's kind of covered our relationship with each other, is one way to put it. Group to group, within the group, people to people. The concepts are, in one sense, a corporate manual to govern how we're going to conduct ourselves with the rest of the world and in the carrying out of the services that we ask to be performed. A trusteeship was formed. There's a reason we have to have that. Let's start with this book. No matter how much we'd like to, my group is not able to publish that and distribute it wide enough. I haven't met a group yet, and I've met some big ones that are able to publish, distribute, and keep it intact. My inclination is there are some places in there that would read better if they only said it this way. And, we need a public information policy that's general to AA as a whole, not each little group or each little district or each little area deciding what our public relations policy is going to be. Bill was willing to do whatever. Dr. Bob was very conservative. So neither one of them by themselves would have been able to lead us into a public information or public relations policy that makes sense. So a trusteeship was formed. And these people were given responsibility for collecting money, utilizing that money correctly, meaning the way we told them to, determining what that public relations policy would be. It's attraction rather than promotion. Where do you draw the line on that? I'm going to tell you a lot of stories between now and when we go, because I learned these by having to operate with them. It doesn't mean I'm a definitive answer to this, but I was on the Public Information Committee, the Trustees Public Information Committee. And it was chaired by an old man who chaired it with a pistol. That was his gavel. It was one of those kind of committees. It wasn't a real gun, but the message was clear. Where do we cross the line? Somebody has to make that decision, and it can't be me or my group or you or your group. It can't be, because it will not be clearly defined. And it's hardly clearly defined anyway. We do public information. It's perfectly okay. The story I want to tell you is about the TV spots that were put together by the Public Information Committee simply to inform the world that AA exists. That's pretty much our policy. We don't promote anything. We just let them know. And it was a really good piece, very professionally done. It showed a fellow on a train going out of New York after work, and then a little cut to the wife and family at home. You got the picture there waiting on him. And he's having a couple slugs along the way. And the information gets across the Gramercy streets where he's going to get off. And then there's a cut of the train going by Gramercy Street, and he's gone. And then the tagline was Alcoholics Anonymous. It works. It really does. And we crossed the line at that point, I think. Alcoholics, if you want information, contact Alcoholics Anonymous, and here's how. It works. It really does. Crosses the line. And that was what we as trustees were responsible for toning up and toning down and then figuring where the markets would be for this. That's pretty heady responsibility, because I know there are groups who don't think we ought to do it at all. There's others who think we ought to promote the hell out of it. But the policy has been established by the conference. guidance, and so we were clear on where we went. We knew when we crossed the line. The fun on the committee was that there were public information types who said, so what? Anyway, we'll get into all that. The basic concept, the basic principle of World Service is this. You and I are entirely, totally, 100% responsible for providing our own services. All AA services must be the responsibility of the collective conscience of the whole fellowship. What an order. We can't even find everybody. So, of course, a conference then was established, whereby representatives of all of the registered groups, and the only reason you have to be registered, if you're not registered, then you don't have a voice. We don't know who you are. You can't send anybody, because there's nobody. We don't know who you are. So those representatives in each area had a bunch of groups, and they would determine one person to go back there, because the Roosevelt Hotel only holds just so many people. And so we put together this conference where the delegates could get together for a week and talk about the business of Alcoholics Anonymous. What kind of literature do we need? I'll never forget Carl Budd. The first year I was a delegate, so was Carl. He came in from Wyoming, and his proposal from Wyoming is we need a moratorium on literature. We have too much. Okay? That was the perception of Wyoming. I tend to agree. We have too much literature. But a moratorium doesn't make sense to me. And so here's your 92 delegates and the trustees and all that begin to have a discussion about that proposal, because it has to be listened to and discussed. That's what the conference is about. That's on the agenda. How much literature do we need? What kind of literature do we need? Who's going to write it? You want to spend group time with that? I don't. So we have established this body of people. And the concepts are the guidelines that we were given to make those kinds of decisions. What we've given them is that we delegate some of our responsibility to a trusted servant. I can't get to New York this year. You go, and you carry our conscience. But if you go to the conference as a delegate instructed instead of informed, why bother with a conference? Okay. That's already shut the thing down. So we delegate them what's known as the right of decision, which we will cover. I knew what you all wanted in this area. When I got to the conference, and I was comfortable, until the first person spoke. Then I got confused, because they wanted something different than what you wanted. And that confusion runs rampant. I'm telling you, it's better than rodeo. But no matter what you told me you wanted me to carry, I could carry that. But the decision making, when it came time for a vote, I had to base that on all of the information that I had gathered that you didn't have. Now I'm responsible to come back and report to you what I did, but I must have the leeway to do that, or why bother to send me? And we grant that to the trustees also. The conference action, for instance, that they asked us one year to put together a report on the feasibility of a film strip based on the pamphlet at Sherbeat's Sitting in a Cell. That's what the delegates said they wanted us as trustees to do. Ain't that? Feasibility. Well, the first thing we found out is that a film strip can only be played on what's known as a Duquesne projector. It's a very specific piece. And maybe one penitentiary in the United States had one. So film strip is out. That could have shut that down if we got legalistic about the conference action. It's not feasible to have a film strip. But we'd been listening. What they wanted was some sort of visual presentation of that pamphlet for the prison population. That is what they wanted. So using the right of decision, we began looking into other media that could be used. And we thought of film. We have film. Film's rather expensive. At that time, if you wanted any of AA's films, you could rent them for, I think it was $145 for, what was it, Chuck, a three-month period or something like that. You could buy it and it cost $300. Not really feasible. As trustee at large, I got around a lot. My style is this. I want to find out what you want. So I'll take what I'm hearing at the conference, like this, should we do this, to all the areas I was getting to. When I got down to Mississippi, and everybody so far was saying, yeah, that would be nice. We don't know how it's going to look yet, but we could use that. The guy in Mississippi said, I like the idea, but we have 72 prison units in Mississippi and two 16-millimeter projectors. But every unit has a VCR. Why don't you put it on VCR? And my response was, if you will write that to the trustees committee, I'll take it to the trustees committee also, because I still think you have to be responsible. We'll get them from both sides. Anyway, the upshot of that was that we spent $32,000 or $36,000 between then and the next conference to have some professionals come in, do a storyboard for us, and then shoot some film so that our report to the conference was, this is what it's going to look like if you want it. Now, we spent $32,000 that would be absorbed if you approved it. If it wasn't, it was just an expenditure. We have to have the right to do that to serve you. Well, they loved it. You know, I have the Sherby sitting in the cell video. And the result of that was everything else got put on video, so now for $15 you can own the film instead of $300. You don't have to rent it. Anybody can get it. That's the kind of thing that right of decision led to. It's one of those pieces. If I'd been instructed to be legalistic, we'd have just shut down. There'd be nothing more to do. Right of participation. We'll get into that one because that was a big one. I got in more trouble over that one than anything else. Everybody has to be able to participate, and the concepts determines who everybody is at the conference. Is it just the trustees? Is it the trustees and directors? Is it trustees, directors, and staff members? Who counts? Who gets to participate in committee activities? And we'll get into all that. That's kind of what we're going to cover here, how this thing actually operates on the street. There's the right of appeal. Doesn't get used very often, but that's a big one. If a decision is wrong, we have a right to appeal it. No punitive action is ever taken. This conference never, ever is allowed to make a governmental decision. And I want to talk a lot about that, and so does Gary. Because we're drifting in that direction. Our service entities are beginning to make governmental edicts. And that's very dangerous for the survival of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of Bill's best writing are in these concepts, if you take time to read them. Very thoughtful. People say they're dull, but that's only because they're dull. Depending on how you look at it. The warranties, my God, and the warranties are statements of principle that cover every aspect of life. So that's what we're going to do with the concepts. There's a total picture here. This is how we operate. And it's very precise. That's what makes it dull. He details what kind of committees we're probably going to need, who should serve on them, who gets to vote on them. And I've got some really racy stories to tell you about all the lumps I took learning these damn things. Because I didn't for this area before I ever heard about the concepts. Now, it doesn't mean somebody didn't mention them. I just never heard about them. And the one piece of advice that I got when I became trustee, I followed David Aronofsky, and I knew I'm going to get instructed, fully instructed. Well, David did call me, and he said, only two things. Learn the concepts as they are in their original 1962 version. And if you hear anything that doesn't fit that, ask questions. And if you don't get answers, pursue it. Then he said, and listen, you little son of a bitch, buy a suit for the trustee-only dinner. And I did. It doesn't fit anymore, but I've got one. Learn them in their original 1962 version, the first version. Because at that time, they were separated, and these can be changed, by the way. Some things can't be, but these can be. And the changes were made a body of the text, so we lost the historical background as to why the changes got made. There's some confusion. Now all changes are footnoted. But the original form is there, and the intent is clear. There has been, and probably still is, a movement to do away with the essays, because again, they clearly define it. The last words I heard is, we'll keep the heavy black print, but we can ignore the rest of this. Hey, I'm hearing it from my A members. So anyhow, that's kind of where we're going to go with this, and I hope we have some fun with it. You've had experience with it, I've had, the troublemaker has. Okay.
Concept one, long form. I'm going off the headers on the top of the essays. There is a list, I think, in the front of that of the long form of the concepts, which is it should read the same. But anyway, the final responsibility and ultimate authority for AA World Services should always reside in the collective conscience of our whole fellowship. And now, that is, again, a statement of the problem. How is this fellowship, the whole fellowship, going to get accountable and responsible for the direction and implementation and conduct of World Services? And the answer was by and through this second concept, which we're going to get into in a little bit. This principle is alive and well in area assemblies, and it depends on... The one word I want to talk about now, we'll get into the other later. That is this principle of mutual trust. We, at the group level, we like the coffee maker. We more or less trust that the door's going to get open, the coffee's going to get made, the chairs are going to be set up. When that don't happen, we get nervous. And so we will trust somebody else with that job until they make us nervous, and so on and so forth. Same thing happens in a group. At the meeting, we will nominate, and sometimes nomination is 10 minutes after 8, somebody goes up to the chair and starts the meeting. That chairperson is given quite a little bit of latitude to chair that meeting in accord with, you know, certainly a format if that's the group conscience. If there is no group conscience, you're liable to have anything. And do. And, but, you know, bottom line, what I'm trying to get to is that this principle runs up and down the length of our services. Area assemblies, we elect GSRs to go represent the groups. There's a number of GSRs that still believe that they've got to take everything that was discussed at that assembly back to the group. There are a number of groups that absolutely want to get into all the crossing of the T's and dotting of the I's of everything the area assembly does and the General Service Conference. There's also a good number of groups that have absolutely less than no interest in anything that goes on above the level of who's making coffee next week. We've got to try to amalgamate all of this and put it together into some type of representative, and I don't like that word, but to try to get a representative cross-section of what the true conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole is. So as you can see, we're going to be talking a lot about Tradition 2. We're also going to be talking a lot about Tradition 9 as we go through this stuff. So this is the problem, and again, I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. Bill was the conscience for AA as a whole, but Bill died in 1971. Dr. Bob died in 1950. So, here we are. We're leaderless, rudderless ship. We had a foundation in place for a number of years. It was called the Alcoholic Foundation. It was a bunch of people that sat around and kind of ran roughshod over us. And we tried to even go so far as to elect alcoholic chairman of the board. And the first two we elected both got drunk. So we quit doing that. And since that time, the foundation subsequently was succeeded by the General Service Board, and which is the principal operating arm of the General Service Conference. That's the legal arm. And the whole situation was exacerbated by the fact that at that time the trustee ratio was considerably in favor of the non-alcoholics. And Bill was successful in changing that. One of the last acts of the things that he did in getting that. And some people say it was a mercy vote. I don't know. But he was able to get the ratio changed. And so alcoholics, primarily, and Alcoholics Anonymous, at least de facto, are the ultimate responsibility and authority for AA World Services. But again, we do it by through the conference structure. A lot of people do not like the conference structure. They disagree with it. They're like me. They're not in favor of the committee system. But unless and until one of us experts comes up with a better plan, this is the plan. And this is how we're going to do things. And like Don said, if, you know, in the event we were able to or ever have to get a hold of everybody, how would we? They made it almost impossible for anything of substance to change. Three quarters of all the groups and all that stuff. So that's my spin, at least on the first concept. I think we were faced with a huge challenge, just a huge challenge. And that's why I still think that in spite of what a lot of people say about Wilson, the guy had a lot of foresight. I mean, he had a lot of foresight, and he was a man of vision.
If I look at these only legalistically, they belong only to the conference and they can be forgotten. I don't look at them legalistically. These are statements of spiritual principle. And if that's true, then I will be able to apply the principle to my entire life. These apply in my home. Gary said it. Most of this is the second tradition taken to the street. This is how it plays out in the real world. Slow down. Okay. I get on a roll, honey. I can't slow it down.
They didn't laugh.
Now they did. There are a number of ways of relating in a family and a home. I do not want to be a despot in my home. I live by these principles. So how this plays out at home is that I understand that the ultimate responsibility and the authority for what goes on in my home must rest in the collective conscience of the people who live there. Then they delegate to me certain responsibilities, and to them certain responsibilities, and these principles will play out. And I'm going to play with that along the way here, because it's the only way I can make it real. Group conscience in a family is critical. I'm not the ultimate authority. Most of the time the kids are far more in touch with reality than I am, and I need to hear from them. But that, I'm just laying a little groundwork. Same in my group. We will see how this covers one of the most dangerous things for me, and I'm sure for most alcoholics. We do have leaders in Alcoholics Anonymous. Their role is that of trusted servant, but there are leaders. We do have personalities in Alcoholics Anonymous. We need to make sure that we encourage that. Not put it down, we just have to have the principles ahead of the personality. If we didn't have personalities and leaders, we wouldn't go anywhere. If God had made been unnecessary. So, I stole that from Chuck. So how am I going to keep that in check when I understand that my family looks to me for certain things, and I've agreed to provide them. My group looks to me for certain things. And at one time, this whole fellowship looked to me for certain things. How do I meet that obligation and that responsibility without my ego taking over? This is how. This is how. So first of all, we created a conference. Concept two. In order to answer this problem, in 1955, the groups confirmed the permanent charter for the General Service Conference. That charter is found in here, by the way. They thereby delegated to the conference complete authority for the active maintenance of our world services, and thereby made the conference, excepting for any change in the 12 traditions or in Article 12 of the charter, the actual voice and effective conscience for the whole society. I remember one trustees weekend. I go back four times a year automatically to conduct the business. This particular one was good. I have a view of that whole trusteeship. When we were in our trustee committees doing the work, we were incredible. Once each weekend, we had a trustee dinner where we all got in our suits and ties, and we became 21 jerks. I hated that dinner. Just never mind. And I've cleaned it up. I didn't used to use that word, did I, Tommy? And then we go to the final board meeting where all the recommendations then are finalized. And at that board meeting, we're getting ready to go home. It's been a good weekend. Even the dinner was good. And Betty came in with a letter. She says, "We have just received a letter from Nancy Reagan. She says that some of our friends would like to propose us for the Nobel Peace Prize, and they want to know if they do that, would we accept it?" And we went berserk. Well, there's precedence for awards like that. We've got the Lasker Award and some others. Humanitarian awards, there's precedence for the fellowship, not for us. Of course, we had AA destroyed. There's the $50,000 award we couldn't take. We talked for an hour just... One of our little staff members spoke up at the end of an hour and said, "It seems to me that this is a 10th tradition problem. This is an outside issue. We really don't have any opinion on this." And that's what we sent back to Nancy Reagan. And then we got a letter back from her saying, "That's about what we thought you would say." So we're continuity. We don't care. It's none of our business at that point. We're structured in such a way that a staff member felt comfortable in a trustees meeting to speak up and give us some guidance. And that's built right into this charter and the way we do business. It's addressed specifically who can do that. The staff is allowed. So now we have a charter, and they are our conscience and our voice. How would you like it if we'd have called you that afternoon in your group and said, "Discuss this and let us know what you want us to say"? We'd still be waiting for an answer. Okay. We've endowed them with that authority to speak our conscience. And it also says something about who we really are. We're a society. I love when Bill uses that word. We're a society within a society. We do not live by the same principles that the rest of the world lives by. We are held to a different standard, one that we set up. We created this. If you don't like it, we created it. The world didn't force us to live this way. We do. So we're a society within a society, and these are the guiding principles. And isn't that nice? I've always hated having to make the final decision. No, I don't have to. I've always truly preferred to get group conscience. No, I do. I don't get off on that. But there we've created this conference. Now, who's going to support it? It goes right back to the first concept. Who's going to support it? We are. We created it. We must support it. So we pay the expenses of our delegate to go to that conference. We should. I don't want to pay for him shopping at Barnes & Noble or going down to the Cattleman. That's on him. But I'll pay the expenses to get him there and take care of the business, because we should. I have an obligation as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to listen to them when they come back. Tell me what the hell they did while they were there. There was a group on the north side of Denver. One of the old members called me in to chew me out and to inform me that we were not giving any more money to that damn general service, because we don't know how they're spending it. Until you tell us how they're spending it, we're not going to give any more. So I gave him the annual report, which is printed and distributed to anybody who wants it, and realized he behaves just like me. It's easier to bitch than to read. We don't like the way you're handling things at the assembly. I said, well, when was the last time you were there? Well, I don't go to that damn thing. Okay? If you don't show up, then live with it. We are responsible for it. Well, and they'll get into who we pick to do these jobs, too, pretty quick.
Concept two, which Don Rand talks about, we could change a few things except for warning. Well, the Article 12, I guess they talk about, of the conference charter. That is a restatement of the warranties, which we're going to talk about in the 12 concept. Just put in a little different language. But this whole thing of, you know, that in 1950, who got to go to Cleveland? Well, whoever could afford it, generally. But it was there that Bill first proposed this conference on an experimental basis. And so at the beginning of 1951, with panel one, we had a four-year period of time where this conference operated on a more or less an experimental basis. And each area, which the country, United States or Canada, was kind of divvied up and asked to elect by some means, which we didn't have a third legacy procedure at that time, somebody to come to this conference to represent that area. It's important to understand that the service structure fell out of and evolved from the General Service Conference. The service structure was not in place. Who was the conscience for the area? It was the old-timers and the ones who could afford to get there. I believe our first delegate was elected by 9 people, something like that, from Colorado. 9 people gathered in a hotel in Denver, and I don't even know which one it was, and elected some guy from Colorado Springs. And why did they elect him? Because he had been to Cleveland in 1950.
And he was
Yeah. They elected him. He was our delegate, first delegate. The end of the four-year experimental period, Bill said, I think this is a fine idea. What do you think? This was in St. Louis. The 8,000 who could afford to get there said, okay, let's try it. And so at that point, Bill said, we've come of age. He transferred the authority for the future of Alcoholics Anonymous from Bob, who was deceased, and himself, to this experimental conference, which he pronounced in a fit of optimism that this was a tremendously successful venture. Ultimately, that's proved to be true. But it was not without a little trial and tribulation, stress and strain, which I'm sure we'll get into. So I think that there's some again, another example of perhaps blind, but nonetheless, I think it was sincere trust that this process could, in effect, take over the active leadership for our World Service of Prayers. But here's the problem. The groups had not delegated any of their responsibilities by this point. Many of the groups, now Bill has just fought the war of the traditions. Many of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time were still dead set against the traditions. Now he's got a whole new battle plan, and they're saying, oh my God, Alcoholics Anonymous will surely cease to exist. And so the resistance had to be almost overwhelming. But nonetheless, he was able to buy through the basically just, again, conforming this thing to the principles that we already had in place. By getting it to conform to that and to bridge the gap, as it were, between our steps and our traditions and form these principles, he was able to affect acceptance of this process by the fellowship. And I think, by and large, cross-section of our fellowship, year to year, they generally accept this process, this conference process. Most groups are willing to support it at some level, whether it be through monetary contributions, whether it be through participation in district meetings, which are all of this is intended to arrive at this group conscience that we keep talking about, that we keep talking about this informed group conscience. Well, now we've got to take it to the next level. And in the doing of that, we needed to find a way to start delegating out and getting rid of some of these responsibilities that the groups had been taking. And so I think I'll just read concept three, and then we'll just kind of launch into that. And probably I don't know, maybe this would be a good time to ask if there's any questions or any comments about what we've covered thus far, if there's any concerns. Yeah, I guess there's probably some.
My name's Kim. I'm an alcoholic. Just an observation, what you were just talking about, how it took a while for people to wake up to the traditions. I see that just in my personal recovery, how it took me a while to wake up to the traditions and then wake up to the concepts. And I think that that's just a part of personal recovery, and that we still see that even today. Just an observation as you just said that.
Very briefly, I want to tack in the family piece to this. Okay. This is the point where you learn the skills of negotiation. We have created a family, a home. We have a primary purpose, growing old together. And now we're going to start delegating some things. Who answers the door after 8 o'clock at night? Who takes the trash down? Who's going to do this? We're going to negotiate some roles in this home so that it can be a free home. So they can just laugh and have some fun. But there are certain things that are going to come up. Who's going to deal with the trash man? 7-year-old? My wife or me? Who's going to deal with the Clampets next door? These are real things. Who's going to deal mostly with these folks out here that keep coming in? And I had to make a shift. My home has always been my refuge. This is their refuge. I learned some hard lessons. This is my family's refuge. And they would like me to kind of be the buffer between them and the intruders. And the third concept, and anybody coming to the door is an intruder. Please understand that, even if they're friendly. They're intruders. They have not been invited. We have to negotiate how we're going to... What do you do with somebody who calls making a sales call at dinner time? Well, they don't want to deal with that. I know what to do. I tell them I don't want to be called at home and hang up. Now, I'm crude enough to do that. They're not. They don't know how to deal with that. It leads us into this third concept, but we have to start negotiating now. Negotiation means talking and listening. The second tradition begins to really come into play here. First time around, I have my opinion, you have yours, she has his, hers, he has his. Now we're all confused, we've got to go around again to find out what we really do want out of this deal and who's going to do what with who.
All right. Well, that's helpful. Because
geez, it would be a long day at school if nobody did. I tell you. It would be a long one.
Okay, concept three.
As a traditional part of creating and maintaining a clearly defined working relation between the groups,
that's that thing he's talking about, clearly defined working relation between the groups, conference, and AA, General Service Board, and its several service corporations, which are Grapevine and AAWS essentially now, staffs, committees, and executives, and of thus ensuring their effective leadership, comma, it is here suggested that we endow each of these elements of World Service with a traditional right of decision. And so, the third step is in essence a decision. The third tradition in essence is a decision. And the third concept in essence is a right of decision. All kind of tied together, kind of nice there. Got that D word in there. If we are going to trust these servants to be the collective voice, if we're going to trust at every level, I'm not limiting this discussion, at least from this end of it, to just the conference. I'm talking about anytime we ask somebody to do something for us, if we're going to ask them to do it, then I think we have to give them latitude to decide how, maybe, to approach this situation, in what manner, and to also have that ability to come back to us and ask us for the resources, if necessary, to accomplish that which we're asking them to do. Now, how many times have you been asked at work to do something and you had absolutely nothing to work with to get it done? Happens every day where I work. Now, these people don't believe in our concepts. I've been teaching them for a long time, but they don't get it. They say, why should you be able to decide? But the guy I work for isn't stupid. He knows that I've got to have enough latitude. And quite frankly, he doesn't understand anything what I do anyway. So he pretty well leaves the decision-making process up to me. And I handle it, you know, the best I can with the information that I have. But oftentimes I don't have enough resources, usually in the way of funds, to take care of what I need to. So I've got to go to him, and he's a banker. So he provides the money. If my decision looks like it's logical, it makes sense, and it looks like it's going to result in some collective good for this little outfit that I work for. And there's been times he's told me, I think that's about the stupidest thing I've ever heard a human being say. I don't believe we're going to do that. And of course, then I exercise my minority right and my appeal, and it's usually frothy and it usually didn't work. So we start over. I don't always like those kind of meetings. No, about you. I can't hardly stand rejection. So, but this principle again is that, you know, Don mentioned it. He talked about this business of sending instructed servants. Those are just message carriers. They're Paul Revere's. And the world's full of people that can just spit out words and repeat. But it takes a special breed of cat to think on their feet and to actually listen, hear, decide, vote, and report. And those, in essence, are our fiduciary responsibilities as trusted servants to our groups, to our district, to our area, to the conference, to the fellowship as a whole. It's a two-way street. But if we don't have this right to decide what we're going to take care of, what we feel in our best interest needs to go back to the groups, what we need to get more information on, what we need to postpone debate and discussion on, what we need to actively pursue debate and discussion on, we're dead before we ever get started.
Simple stuff. Print the book for us. Distribute it. Okay. We've got to give them the right of decision to decide who's going to be the printer. We've got to be able to look at cost. This is just basic stuff. We have a cap, you know. The way we operate now is that we cannot go past 1 year. Our printing reserve is 1 year's operating expenses based on last year. for all the entities. It goes above that, there's no place to put it. So what will happen is an adjustment will be made in all literature prices, the costs will come down, so we can absorb that money back in. We've got to give them a right to keep track of all that, to spend that money. Distribution is a problem. How do you get these books out there? I don't want to have to deal with that. I just want to be able to go buy one when I need one. So they have the right of decision to who's going to print it, who's going to distribute it, how it's going to be bound. They do not have the right to decide about content. Content, we said, it stays the same. Don't change any of that. This is not. It's been changed once, by the way. In the first edition, Doctor's opinion is page one. In all first edition printings. We don't know why it changed, but it did. We didn't give them permission. Somebody did it. So some of us are raising hell about that now. It's too late, but we're raising hell. Anyway, they have the right of decision to decide on that. This is right of decision. What's the service manual going to look like? This or this? You want to fool with that in your meeting? I don't. So we've endowed them with the right to decide what's this going to look like. I thought this was pretty classy when we did it. How are the changes going to be made? Well, we've given them instructions on changes in the concepts. They're to be put in as footnotes. Okay? Those were instructions, so they carry that out. They don't have a right to decide that, only they got to decide what's this going to cost. Those are decisions that I don't want to have to make, so we've delegated that to them. They have the right to make those decisions. The carrying out of our instructions from the conference has to be left to their discretion. I told you the one story about the video. There are many, many stories like that. And they don't always make good decisions, I can promise you that. We made some bad decisions along the way. But we can rectify that. Next weekend, if you get a chance, by the way, Jim Estelle is going to be here for that corrections conference. Former head of the Texas Department of Correction and one of our finest non-alcoholic trustees. And he simplified this whole thing in his final talk as he rotated out. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous is a self-correcting society because of these built-in principles. If you get a chance, come up and meet with Jim. He's one hell of a guy. I need to know when I'm serving you that I have a right to make some decisions based on information. And I don't always have to. When we discovered the big book was in the public domain, can you imagine the chaos that would have happened if we'd all called you all up and just said that and asked you, now what do you want us to do about it? Because of this concept, Wayne Parks, who was then our General Service Office Manager, and a couple trustees, immediately knew what the problem was and went straight to Hazleton, got on an airplane and went to talk with Hazleton, because the fact is they can print it a lot cheaper than we can. We have to buy printers. They have their own print shop. And they went to deal with the problem at that level, first of all, with Hazleton, CompCare, and some of our other big buyers to find out what they were going to do and to negotiate with them. And, of course, Hazleton said, out of respect, we won't do that. We just keep buying from you. It's still pretty cheap. And out of respect, and they're still holding that line. They had the right, and they didn't hesitate for a second to go do that. Then they reported back what the problem was to the rest of the trustees, so we could report on back to you with a solution. Okay. How do you feel when somebody asks you to do a job and then you don't have the authority to do it? Bad. I'll make my mistake and take my lumps if I screwed up. But don't micromanage me. It just doesn't work. So we must not, and we've set it up so we don't micromanage them. We just ask that they report back. And every year, by the way, there's a full report, word for word. I'm an extemporaneous speaker, and they made me write every talk I gave, and then they put it in a book. And I had to learn some new economies. But if you want to know what the conference is doing, they report every year. Full financial report, all the delegates' reports. The only thing you won't get is what happened at the delegates-only meeting, and you don't want to know. There's a bitch session at the beginning of each conference where all the delegates get to spend the whole evening together bitching about everything that's wrong. And they get that dealt with and get into making everything right. So you don't want to know what happened there.
Do we have any questions so far?
We're about at the break.
About break time, yeah. Are you getting kind of an image of what this structure's really about?
Yeah, Lenny. I have a question. Are we going to revisit the last traditions before the end of this?
If you want to, of course.
Why? I would rather do it the group as a whole likes to do, but that's something I don't want to miss.
The anonymity?
From the family
for me,
you know,
and
you guys
went from. Oh, we did. We just kind of shot right through that, didn't we? All right, how about when we start up, we'll do that. 7 o'clock startup time? A little dinner, yes? Huh? We're going to regather here at 7 o'clock, and we'll start off by covering the family aspect of those last two traditions, and then move on forward here by. Drew Estes with garbage.
No, but if you do, we'll understand.
No dumpster diving.
If this type of activity like we've had this weekend has interested you, there's another facet of this, that is this in the region with every other year, in the even number of years, we have a regional service assembly. This year it'll be in Oklahoma City, the 13th, 14th, and 15th. This is a function that's put on by all of the areas within our region. And it's October 13th, 14th, and 15th in Oklahoma City at the Clarion Meridian Hotel. And if you kind of like service, you kind of think this is all right, and you want to spend a little time talking about concepts or traditions, or maybe you're liking corrections work, or maybe public information is your cup of tea. There'll be people from every area in our region at this thing, and they'll be discussing nothing but that. So there are some, I believe, Dave Flyers up front still, and then this was given to me, so I just thought this is an absolute AA deal. There's not any secrets here. This is not one of those, just one of those things that I think a lot of people generally in the fellowship aren't always aware of. So this is as good a chance as any to kind of play that thing. We started having these in the region in 1987 in Denver. We took the first one, and it's been, I think, now this will be the last one. I think maybe got one more, and then we'll be back in Colorado. So I've never missed one of these, and I really enjoy it, and I strongly encourage you to avail yourself of that resource if you see fit. Before we get going along again on the concepts, we were told that we basically kind of failed to talk about some of the other things with relation to the last four or five traditions. And so we're going to try to get that out of the way now and satisfy that requirement. And then we'll, I guess, go on to the remainder of the concepts that we can get through tonight. And Don has some things he wants to say about those aspects of the tradition that we kind of failed to discuss.
Really?
Yeah. Filling all the cracks.
If I heard right, what was requested was somehow to link anonymity with the job. And with the family. Is that okay? There's nothing noble in the story I'm going to tell you. It's simply an application of principle, not because I'm smart, but because I'm a spiritual being having a human experience, and I must live the way I'm going to talk about it. I don't have any choice. I had an opportunity, what's it been, 5.5 years ago, in the midst of a desperate time for me. I was dying of hepatitis. A number of things were going on. It wasn't a good time. Department of Corrections down there establishing alcohol and drug treatment in 15 penitentiaries. That was my job. And to supervise that activity. And I'd never done anything like that before. But I went because my hero, Tom Ivester, asked me to go. And I figured I'm safe enough because he'll show me what to do. And he did. He showed me my office and said, goodbye. Reports are going to get changed. Anyway, after that was over, it was time for me to come home. The next step for me was a very impressive, high salary, high profile executive job. And I really don't ever want to do that. I've done it once. It's a pain in the butt. But mainly it was simply time for me to come home. So I quit. I let go of that position, if you will. And the next day, the director of the facility where I now work called. And he said, these people are going to give me $1 million to put together something, and I'll take it if you'll come work with me. Well, I didn't have anything else to do, so I said, sure. Besides, I had waited for a number of years to work with him because he had some talents that I really wanted to see how he did what he did. So we put that together. Now, that's just the background. This place was one of the worst facilities in the entire state when we got here. That was part of the problem. Highest escape rate, lowest completion rate. It was the drug house in the neighborhood. It was a mess, and part of what we were to do was to quietly go in there and first get some of that straightened out and then establish this alcohol and drug program I'd been working in North Carolina with. So I went down, he wanted me to go in a week ahead of time before he got there, just so he'd have some frontline troops already in place. And I interviewed with the director at the time, and after a minute and a half, just said, this won't work, and left the building. And called George and said, that's who I work for, I don't work. Well, nothing to do with it. So I said, I need you there. Tell you what. I just need you there. What's available? I said, well, I got a job for the van driver. I got some kid driving the van around doing errands. I took that job. Okay, $8 an hour. Driving the van around doing errands. Because my commitment to him is I will do whatever it is you need to have me do to get this project together. I knew what the project was and where I really fit, but that wasn't ready yet. Now, this van job was interesting. In addition to just running little errands, the main thing was to go around. These inmates are required to have a job. I'd go by the job, make sure they were actually there. Some of them were on non-residential status. I'd check the house and see if that's where they really lived. It was kind of interesting, but it didn't take a lot of time. It was taking this other kid 8 hours a day, and I was getting it done in about three. And I needed something to do. Now, my life is based on serving others. It truly is not, this is not nobility. I just need something to do. So I started looking around. How can I be of service in this god-awful mess here? Well, part of the mess was that the staff is overworked and underpaid. There's way too much for anybody to get done, and everybody expects it to be done yesterday. And I had 5 or 6 hours a day free, just hanging around doing nothing. So you had a job to do that would interfere with you getting your real job done. I just started doing that. And then I pick a piece of yours, and I pick a piece of yours. And pretty soon, I had become a department. The intake department. Because one of the most important things we do is transport inmates from one facility to another, which is the scariest time in any human being's life. You think moving is tough? Try this one. So my job became to transport them and to help them make the transition from there to here. Little stuff. How would you like to be called? Mr. So-and-so. Well, I had a tough little black gangster one time whose name was Cleophas, and I knew that is not how he wanted to be called. I asked him, what would you like me to call you? He said, call me Butch. Okay. These are some of the things. Now, if I'm tied up with me, I can't do that. Okay. I will be exercising power over this poor bastard. What he doesn't know in my mind, if he wants to escape, he can have the keys to my van. I don't care. Okay. Just let me out first, that's all. For our purposes, I just by accident became a department. The intake coordinator of the intake department. And then my real job came about. The other stuff got straightened out. We found one of our staff members selling clean urines to the inmates, so needed to clean that one up. Had him arrested right out of the place. But then my real job came up. Now, there are benefits to being anonymous. Because I was truly anonymous. Nobody knew who the hell I was. The van driver. I got a great benefit. Because when I moved into what I'm really supposed to do, by accident, by simply being of service and nothing less, I left behind me a position that someone else could come in and take. That's tangible stuff. Okay? Create a job for somebody. By staying anonymous. By not being George's fair-haired boy. Not being the one who's getting ready to do all this. Just the van driver. Had to wear a tag because they didn't even know my name. That's one of the ways that applies. If I will just be of service and do what needs to be done. Currently, I'm in such a good position, I'm almost ashamed to tell anybody about it. I work 20 hours a week because I discovered along the way that my 40-hour a week job is because I was spending 20 hours a week doing your job in order to get to mine. So I said, no more of that. I'll go do mine. I don't report to anybody. I'm out of the pay matrix. I pick my own hours, I do what needs to be done, and I found I could do that in 20 hours a week. It's getting to be bad. I'm getting good at it, and I can do it in 16 hours a week now. So I'm looking around for somebody's department to meddle with.
Okay.
That's one aspect of anonymity as I understand it. God through me, what needs done, I'll do that. Part of the problem we have at work is that you work for probation and I work for William Street and DLC needs a piece of paper that your clerk has. And if I don't get it, then they raise hell with me and I raise hell back down the line. It gets to be a real bad scene. Well, when I got hooked into that, it was a bad scene. I unhooked from it, got anonymous again. And what I do, I went to you and found out what your problem was. And I brought my paperwork to you in the process. And you got used to me showing up with the stuff you needed from me, and automatically you had my stuff ready when I got there. And so I could pass it on. Pretty soon we got a free-flowing thing going on here based on my need to just be of service. The best way for me to get my job done is to make sure you get yours done. Instead of bitching about it, which I did, I got inventory about that bitch. And when she stopped being a bitch and became the same person I am, then we got this other thing done. That's part of how I understand the application of anonymity. I can't define it. Being in the right place at the right time to do the thing and move on and not take any credit, and that's really hard. But you're moving through. I have no authority whatsoever. None. I can't tell anybody to do anything. And about half of them think I run the place. Because when you let go of all that and become truly anonymous, I really do. Because I know who does, and I have their ear, the information gets passed. Does that make any sense? It's hard to discuss because it sounds like a big ego trip. it could be. Anonymity is a dangerous place to be. Okay. Because it always could be an ego trip, because there's immense power in true anonymity. I don't care who gets the credit. I'm only interested in getting the job done. Same thing in AA. In fact, if you get really anonymous, I've discovered that there's another wonderful dimension to that. I'll make real sure you get the credit for whatever got done. And you'll cooperate with me and everybody else once that happens. And why shouldn't you get the credit? I mean, I don't need it. God, if I get credit, then I get another title. If I get another title, I get another staff. And if I get another staff, I got more problems again. I don't need it. Does that make any sense to you? Okay. I'm anonymous at home because I'm just dad and grandpa. I'm not the boss. I told you I live in a matriarchy and I like it that way. The only thing they're absolutely certain of is that I'm mostly incompetent and need cared for. Which is truer than you know. Okay, that's the personal touch to it. Anonymity, of course, for the fellowship is a protection of you from me and me from me. Because God did the whole thing. I can't even get locked up in the right place on my own. That's all I can tell you.
Do we have any questions or discussion on the first three concepts? All right. We were talking about a little blue book that contained just the 12 concepts. Gary has one. You want to hold it up?
Another one in the back.
There's another one back there. Brad's got one. Apparently, these are pretty popular. So anyway, that's a Gary's, I think, an 89 model. All right, concept four. Throughout our conference structure, we ought to maintain at all responsible levels a traditional right of participation, taking care that each classification or group of our world servants shall be allowed a voting representation in reasonable proportion to the responsibility that each must discharge. There's a long-standing concern and dispute in Alcoholics Anonymous with respect to the General Service Conference about the voting of staff members. How come those people vote? How come grapevine directors vote? How come some of our trustees vote? And so on and so forth. And this principle was set up so that these people have, even though our staff members, for example, are paid workers, they have a unique ability to hear some of the things from the fellowship that most of us are never going to get exposed to. They're there on the firing line every day fielding the calls and receiving the mail. And their influence is, I think there are only 9 or 12 staff members total. It's questionable whether they could ever cause a great big huge pile of people to vote if they had some particular passion or something like that they thought they had to get taken care of. But they do have a lot of experience that they can bring to the table and discuss. So, and they do. And they are allowed to vote under this particular concept. I don't personally find it to be there's any dispute involved. Although I know a lot of members, a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous really question it. There was some degree of concern in the early going whether or not the General Service Office Manager ought to have the right to vote, and that's been taken care of through this principle. And it's a little difficult to believe, but you know, in the beginning, the method of rule in Alcoholics Anonymous was purely authoritarian, you know, because there wasn't anything against it. And so that has evolved, thankfully, into this participatory type of structure, which is more or less along the corporate model.
One of my tasks on the board was chairing the corrections committee. Now, that means we had 3 trustees, a staff member, And the staff members, what would you call them? The person that wrote down the notes.
Secretary.
Thank you. I'm real careful these days. And then, as with all committees, since the committees don't make any decisions, we bring in advisors from the area that we're working in. We had some prison people, because we're trying to find the best way to go through all the hoops you have to jump through. What do we need? So we had a total of, I think it was 9, because you want an odd voting. And the only voting the committee does is to vote on the proposal that will go to the board and to the conference for final ratification. But we bring consensus to them on what we've done the scut work. We've gone out there and found out what needs to be done. I got a call one day, and one of our committee members had resigned, which brought it to 8. And the general service office manager very kindly said, we'll get you another one. And I said, no, please don't do that. And first of all, the committee will decide if they need another one. And if we do, then we'll make a selection. But thank you for the offer. And I went to this to find out how we were to go about that. We needed a voting member. But the question among the committee was, do we need to bring another person on to make it 9? Well, this says, the General Service Board rigorously abides by the principle of participation whenever its chairman makes appointments to the board's principal standing committees. Numbers of non-trustees and paid staff workers are customarily chosen for these important posts. As with the active service corporations, the same elements are nearly always present in these committees. Representatives of the General Service Board, the trustees, non-trustee experts, our advisors, and one or more staff members who do most of the legwork. All can vote and therefore can truly participate. When there comes time to ballot, there are no superiors, no inferiors, and no advisors. So I brought this to our committee and we said, wait a minute, our staff member hasn't been voting. All we got to do is just follow this. Let the staff member have a voting participation, and we're covered. We've got 9 votes. We're out again. You have never seen such a stink. Oh, staff members voting in committee? I mean, some people went berserk.